and delighted to welcome with us to this hearing of Cooley Christian School students. Would they please stand? Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. I see you may even have a special interest in this case. This involves your school, but that's great. The students are here with a award-winning, national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. And under this program, we invite high school students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. And if the school decides to come, then we send materials about the case to the students, and they may engage in outside activities relating to this case. And then as part of the process of this program, the students are invited to come to a session with a justice and other students who have been here to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues. And I forgot to ask Justice Wilkinson, were the Cooley Christian School students here? I don't think so. Well, they can answer now. Were you here at noon to talk about this case? Well, if you would wish to stay afterwards, and I don't know what your schedule is for returning to your home area, a justice could come and talk with you for a few minutes about the procedures, but we can handle that after this case is heard. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Rogan-Sack. And to on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I am going to now call our third case of today. 078P496 Cooley Catholic School versus Luck. Arguing, and let me call the lineup so I'll all agree. Arguing on behalf of Cooley Catholic Schools will be Attorney James G. Birnbaum. For 15 minutes, David C. Rice, Assistant Attorney General, will argue for LIRC, that's Labor and Industry Review Commission, and the Department of Workforce Development. And then for 15 minutes, Dawn Marie Harris will argue. She is counsel for Wendy Ostlund. And then, Mr. Birnbaum, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. All agreed?
Your Honor, is in reverse order.
It is in reverse order? Okay. Ms. Harris will argue first. Okay, thank you. That's why I do it. This is one of the few times in all the years I've done it that there was an error, but it shows it was worthwhile doing it. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Birnbaum.
May it please the court, my name is Attorney James Birnbaum, and along with me representing the appellant, Cooley Catholic Schools, is Attorney Jessica Kirshner from my office, Attorney Ross Seymour, and Attorney Aaron Birnbaum. The case that we're going to be talking about today squarely presents the question of whether the government can select and order a religious school to employ who shall teach its doctrine, conduct its worship, and incorporate religious tenets into all subjects. While the most compelling intrusion is the remedy, the order, the process is likely intrusive as well. These intrusions are not permitted by the First Amendment. In order to, I think, put in context the importance of this First Amendment issue, The court can basically go back and look at the history of our country, and particularly relating the history of our country to the First Amendment. And I think with regard to Catholic schools, especially the case of Pierce versus Society of Sisters underscores how far back in our history, in our legal history, the importance of having religious schools independent from government intrusion. And it's important to understand that under the Pierce versus Society of Sisters case, it underscored the fact that Catholic schools were formed for the specific purpose to carry on their religious belief. And for that reason alone, the court perhaps could recognize back then it wasn't just a question that public schools were not teaching religion. In some cases, public schools did teach religion, or at least had prayer in schools, and the problem was it wasn't a Catholic prayer. Historically, then, what has happened is those schools that were created were traditionally staffed. The teachers in those schools were, by and large, exclusively clergy, ordained clergy, and religious. And that tradition carried on down as far as the teachers in that school up until very recently, and when I say very recently, I confess to my age because I remember the sisters and the priests in those schools. But what's happened then is that these priests and religious were replaced in the schools by persons who are not either members of religious orders or ordained. On the other hand, what's important to note, however, is despite the fact that the teachers themselves are no longer priests and religious in many cases, the role, the function, the duty is identical to what priests and religious did at the time of Pierce versus Society of Sisters.
Counsel, does the Cooley School set the curriculum that a first grade teacher will teach both religious and academic?
Yes.
And if that first grade class were taught by a nun rather than a lay teacher, would the curriculum have been the same or different?
It would be the same.
So the only religious function that the school set out for first graders was that which whoever was teaching the class taught. Is that correct?
No. I'm not sure exactly what the question is, Your Honor, but with regard to what's taught, I think it's important to understand the difference between a public school and a religious school as it relates to what's taught as far as religion. Religion is not just a subject. Religion is the where-all and be-all. It is the extension of the pulpit. In the public school arena, public school teachers are admonished that they are not to use their classrooms as pulpits. For religion teachers in Catholic schools, the classroom is the pulpit.
Well, my question went to this, and I see this case turning somewhat about where you focus your attention. If you do like the Court of Appeals did, and you focus it on the teacher and the amount of time a teacher spends teaching religion as compared with the amount of time the teacher spends teaching math and reading and other academic subjects, just looking at religion, and I understand your argument that it's interwoven in everything, but just bear with me. You will come up with religion being a small part of the job of the teacher. But if you look at it in the same light, but that all of the religion that is taught in first grade, in classes, in helping with liturgy, without this overlay that I understand you also want to put in. But if you look at it from the perspective of the school, then the teacher is teaching 100% of the religious function for the class, rather than looking at it from the teacher's perspective, where what she's teaching as religion is a small percent. So I think, to me at least, the case seems to determine a little bit upon whose perspective are you looking at the questions from, that of the teacher and what she's assigned to do, or that of the school district and what they have asked the teacher to do. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, and in fact, Your Honor, I think both are true. But primarily, I think, given the fact that schools and Catholic schools are an extension of the teaching mission of the church, the predominant consideration has to be what the teachers are expected to do. And of course, in this case, we don't have a real issue regarding that because of the incorporation statement. And so with regard to the importance of which one is more important, that would be it. And Justice Rogensack, you raised the concern that we have with regard to the application of that time test. Mm-hmm. You know, when you take a look at seven subjects on the report card, seven subjects that you evaluate, and one of the fundamental flaws with the time test is this, and that is it equates religion with gym class. And venture to say that if you would tell the Catholic Church that the class of religion that they teach, and of course I think I've mentioned before, it is more than a class. It is an extension of the pulpit. But to suggest to the Catholic Church that all we have is a public school secular subjects with one religion class, or that religion is no different as far as a subject of is concerned than gym class. We have exactly what the issue is and the problem we have, and one of the problems we have with the time test.
Let me ask you this. What I hear you saying, which may or may not be what you are saying, what I hear you saying is that the whole curriculum for this first grade, whole curriculum, is permeated with religion.
Yes.
It follows then, it seems to me, in your argument, but let's see if that's the argument you're making, follows then that this teacher, indeed the Cooley Catholic schools, are not governed by the discrimination laws of this state. Because to govern them by these discrimination laws is an invasion of their First Amendment rights. Is that your argument?
For those teachers, Your Honor, in which they teach religion, they...
Even a half hour a day.
Even a half hour a day, if they participate as leaders in liturgy, and most importantly, if they incorporate those religious concepts into all the subjects that they teach.
Well, does it show that she incorporated religion into mathematics?
She's admitted that.
Counsel?
Yes.
What? I'm sorry, Chief. Well, is that your argument that you shouldn't even be here, that these law just does not apply?
No, I think what...
In this circumstance. If it were a janitor, it might be something else.
Well, but more than that, Your Honor, I am not, and we're, Cooley Catholic Schools here is not maintaining and asking for a broad-based exclusion of every Catholic school teaching position, claiming that they're all ministerial or would satisfy that. Now, I realize that the church takes the position that, in fact, they have an obligation to convey the Catholic faith. But with regard to what we're arguing here is, and we agree with the Court of Appeals and several of the courts that we've cited, that what the court has to do is analyze the position on a case-by-case basis. Unlike some of the cases,
okay.
It's not categorical.
All right. Then you want us to look at this teacher and what she does.
Correct.
All right. What test do we apply?
All right. I would recommend the following, Your Honor, and that would be, number one, if any aspect of her duties as a teacher requires her to teach religion. And as I've described what that means in a Catholic school, that means not just a subject, that means the indoctrination into the belief it's off limits. Secondly, I believe the standard ought to be is that if a teaching position requires the individual to participate, not just participate, but lead liturgies, in this case, for example, writing prayers, selecting scriptural readings. And I want to emphasize to the court the importance here of the age of the children. We're talking here about a first grade teacher. I don't know what argument or whether or not we would even be here if, in fact, there was a different position, for example, at the high school level, where you don't have the coming together of the teaching of religion, of the worship, and then, of course, of the incorporation. I believe, candidly, Your Honor, that there would indeed be positions in Catholic schools that may not qualify for the ministerial exemption, depending upon what they do.
So you're accepting the ministerial exemption as applicable in this case?
Yes.
So then we have to just decide what is that exemption and what are the facts here that fit.
Right.
And you're doing the facts. If there's any aspect of the duty that requires teaching religion,
correct,
it's ministerial.
Right.
If the teaching position leads liturgies, that's ministerial.
Correct.
What's the third fact?
The third would be the incorporation argument, Your Honor, and that is, if you have a teaching position,
incorporation of religion
into all the subjects that they teach.
And in this case, you have all three.
We have all three, Your Honor, and our position is that all we needed was one.
Okay.
And that is, if the position would have just simply meant that she taught religion, we're asking, Your Honor, that any position which actually teaches religion should
qualify. I have just one more question at this moment. And that is, as I read some of these cases, they talk about primarily. Are you getting rid of the primarily test?
The problem with the primarily test is, what does that mean? And how do you determine it? And unfortunately, what many of those cases have done, Your Honor, is to simply adopt this time test. And that is, if there's seven subjects and one of the subjects is religion, therefore...
So you don't like the time test?
Pardon?
You don't like the time test. But suppose she only taught religion for a half hour every day.
Yes.
Opened the classes with prayers,
right,
closed it with prayers, and taught religion half a day.
Right.
Would that be ministerial?
Yes, and for this reason, and that is that the ministerial function, or the ministerial type function that she performs, is conveying the doctrine. And if you look at the remedy in the case, I mean, many of these, in fact, the majority of cases cited by Mr. Agnes Harris, are really attempts at categorical definitions in this case. But essentially, if you are having a court or an administrative agency order a religious school, which is an extension of the pulpit, as to who shall teach its doctrine, we believe that whether that's one
class
or
three classes... This case doesn't involve who should teach the doctrine. This case says you can decide, a church or whoever runs the school can decide the doctrine, who teaches it.
Right.
This says you can't fire her on the basis of age.
Right. The issue, though, Your Honor, is ultimately on remedy.
Pardon?
She is. In this case, she did, and it was required to teach the doctrine.
I understand that, but it doesn't say you had to hire her to do that. You just can't fire her for an illegal, and in this case, age discrimination. That's what they're saying.
Right, but if you carry it to its logical conclusion, Your Honor, and you focus on remedy, which most of these cases haven't even looked at, ultimately, what will happen in the case is if a teacher who is teaching religion, and if the school is found to have, which of course so far in this case it hasn't, this is a no probable cause case.
That's right. We haven't even gotten to the main event.
Right. We haven't even gotten there. But with regard to that, if any aspect of that is of the teaching or the conveyance of the doctrine, Your Honor, what you have is you have a court, a civil entity, ordering a religious school who will occupy that pulpit in the classroom. That, in our opinion, is a violation and a serious intrusion.
That's the remedy. Okay, thank you, Counsel. When you say the remedy, you're talking about reinstatement?
Yes, we are talking about reinstatement, Your Honor.
But doesn't the law provide that any kind of reinstatement is discretionary under Chapter 111? If I recall, if if both sides don't want reinstatement, the court or reinstatement cannot be ordered. If one side does not want reinstatement, the court has discretion as to whether it wants to give compensation or other remedy in lieu of reinstatement. That's my recollection of that statute.
Well, Your Honor, with regard to this case, the complainant wants reinstatement.
Well, you don't.
Well, we of course don't.
No, that's right. And so the court, so reinstatement isn't automatic, as I understand the law. The court is has discretion under Chapter 111.
Well, and then that goes to Justice Abrahamson's question. Is it only the remedy? No. There are other aspects of the process that indeed would then become intrusive. So it's not just the fact that the ultimate remedy, which I think probably is more alarming than anything, and that is a court ordering a religious school to rule and teach.
Let me make sure I kind of check off my mental checklist here. I understand that you agree that the court has subject matter jurisdiction, or there is subject matter jurisdiction, but that your position is it should be precluded from exercising that jurisdiction under the circumstances of this case.
Correct. I think the mere fact that the legislatures, in this case it would be the Wisconsin legislature, has granted jurisdiction in this case. So this is not a jurisdictional issue. It's the exercise of that authority.
Wouldn't all elementary school teachers who are full-time teachers then be exempted under your argument?
No. In fact, that is not what we're maintaining here.
Okay.
What we're maintaining here is we agree with the Court of Appeals in their five reasons. The first reason they articulated is that in order for the test to be applied, it has to be a case-by-case analysis. We agree with that.
But your argument at its heart seems to me to be that, look, there is, if let's take St. Patrick's School in Onalaska as it exists today, and I don't know how it exists today, but let's say it has grades 1 through 6 and that each grade has a full-time teacher.
All right.
And that each full-time teacher teaches the age-appropriate core curriculum, whatever that is, and that each full-time teacher, grade 1 to 6, also has a religion class one half an hour a day. And each full-time teacher also starts the day with the Pledge of Allegiance and a short prayer, and then after recess has a short prayer. And that each full-time teacher at St. Pat's, as well as every other school in the diocese elementary school, then will take the kids to church and help when it's their turn to prepare the liturgy. If that is the job description of all elementary teachers in all of the diocese, and I'm not saying it is, I'm saying if it is, then are they all exempted from the protections of the WFPA?
Certainly.
Okay.
Let me explain why I say that. Because it is not it is permissible on a case-by-case basis to inquire what they do. The mere title, for example, of a position would not be necessarily controlling. I mean, obviously, churches and different institutions call positions different things. And so I think fundamentally you'd have to take a look at what they actually do. And in your scenario, there were two aspects that I think, I didn't know whether part of the hypothetical. Was there an admission by the employee that she incorporates religion into all the classes that she teaches? And secondly, was how active was she in the actual liturgy aspect? I mean, writing prayers and that sort of thing. If you would say, if your hypothetical, Your Honor, is, do they do those things that the complainant in this case did? We believe the ministerial exemption should apply. But I'm going to suggest to the court that that's not what I expect or would see as being the result. We are not seeking a categorical exclusion.
It seems to me at times I read that you are, in that it's the argument that inherent in teaching is that it should cover all phases of the curriculum. And so if you accept that in the situation. It covers all phases. It's a way of being with the world, if you will, that it seems to me under that argument that you advance at times, then all of those people would be exempted. Because if they are all expected to bring the religious beliefs into all of the classes.
Right. And, Your Honor, I think with regard to the general teachings of the Church, if that were the only factor you looked at, then you could make that argument. But that's not where it stops, because the cases do say that the court in the Yaz case, we learned from the lawyer who actually represented the plaintiff in that case that it's Yaz, so I don't want to...
Yeah, we'll accept that.
And I'll refer to the case any way you'd like me to refer to the case.
Yaz is fine.
And basically what that case stands for is that you have to consider, in fact you have to give great deference to what the Church considers the position and the importance of the position. But the inquiry doesn't stop there. I think you are entitled to inquire into what they actually do as part of it. Now, I can give you some hypotheticals, Your Honor.
Before you do that, Yaz adopted the Rayburn test, which was the primary duty test. Are you asking us to overrule that part of Yaz that adopts the primary duty test?
To the extent that the primary duties test did not correctly address the question of those who teach religion. Our position is that anyone who is hired and actually teaches religion in the sense that's required in a Catholic school, they should be exempt, because to do otherwise would empower a court to tell the school who should teach its doctrine. Mm-hmm.
So even if they teach it for 1/2 hour a day, that is their primary...
If the hypothetical is such, and their assigned duties are to teach religion, then yes, indeed, we believe that the ministerial exemption should apply, even if it's 1 hour a day.
Do all elementary teachers in the Diocese of La Crosse teach religion as
no.
a part of their curriculum?
No. What is happening, and that's why I'm saying we're not seeking a categorical exclusion of those positions. It's a case-by-case basis, because in the Diocese of La Crosse, we have 7 school systems, which would include a high school, a middle school, and several elementary schools. We have 74 elementary schools. And, Your Honor, there are as many varieties of who does what as there are the numbers of positions. You have, for example, on the one end, you may have a school with 4 teachers who teach 8 grades. My guess would be is that all of them teach religion. On the other hand, if you get into the 6th grade in the middle school model, my guess would be is very few of them would actually teach religion, because as you advance in age and as the grades go up, it becomes more specialized. And so you have, for example, a math teacher or a science teacher.
What about elementary 1 through 6?
Elementary 1 through 6, I don't believe there's a categorical requirement of all of them to teach religion in the way the diocese is currently set up. We would have to take a look at each of the locations to determine that. And as you can probably guess, with the limited resources, many times it's going to be assigned to who's ever available. And so, for example, you may indeed have a science teacher who has a minor in religious education. They might be assigned to teach religion. Or you may have a social studies teacher who may teach 3 or 4 classes of social studies and 2 of religion. Our position is that if anything that they're required to do in terms of teaching religion occurs, then the ministerial exemption should apply to us there again. Courts ought not to be telling religious schools who should occupy that religious education pulpit. And likewise, I think with regard to the whole issue of liturgy, which is another, I think, touchstone, where there ought to be, courts ought not to be telling people who should write the prayers, select the readings for religious organizations and with regard to their ecclesiastical and with regard to their religious exercises and liturgies.
Mr. Birnbaum, thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you. Attorney Harris, counsel for Wendy Ostley.
May it please the court, and it's an honor to be here, also nerve-wracking. But I am here to represent the interests of Wendy Ostland. The case has been going on now for 7 years. She is currently 60 years old, and this is an age discrimination case. I do view Attorney Birenbaum's argument as one that is asking for more or less an absolute standard, and no religion within the United States gets an absolute waiver and immunity from the law. Criminal laws apply, and in this case, public policy has weighed in favor of passing some very substantial anti-discrimination laws that protect individuals on the basis of race, age, gender. All of you are aware of those laws.
Mr. Birenbaum comes close, but he doesn't say all teachers. He says any teacher who teaches any aspect of religion is exempt.
But yet there's this argument that appears to be coming out that religion is infused in all of these subjects that are admittedly taught in a secular manner, and then just because of a 20 or 30 minute class in religion, and I've already conceded that had my client, goes more into the entanglement argument, been a bad teacher of religion and not a religious reason as the reason supporting the termination, that the analysis would be different. But in this case, the reason given is not one based on religion. It was a certification issue that my client was argued in
on. Counselor, do you agree with Attorney Birenbaum that the Cooley District sets the curriculum that your client was required to teach for first grade?
Yes.
They set the religious aspects of it and the academic aspects of it, if we can separate them out?
In her view, yes, they did, but they were a lot different than what the reality is of what they're arguing in the case.
Okay, so so if she taught religion for a half an hour, 4 days a week, she did it for a half an hour because that's what the school district required?
Absolutely. Ironically, she was never evaluated on her religious
instruction. Right, I understand that. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, again, if you look at what was 100% of the religious duties that a first grade teacher was supposed to do, according to the school district, did she perform them?
She did, but what's ironic here is they're arguing that it's a pulpit, and yet non-Catholic teachers were hired and allowed to teach religion.
I understand your argument in that regard. I'm just trying to look at whose lens do we look at this through? Do we look at whether she fulfilled 100% of the religious function that the religious school required, or do we look at it on a time basis vis-a-vis other academic subjects as the Court of Appeals examined it? And that was really examined from what her day-to-day function was. So if the, quote, function is the Cooley District's function, I think you get one answer. If the function is Ms. Osland's function, I think you could come up with another answer.
And we obviously agree with the Court of Appeals analysis and the longstanding precedent on what substantiates the primary duties of the day. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they didn't opt to go into the entanglement arguments, but beyond that, I do think it's relevant that there is absolutely no religious-based reason for this termination in this case.
Was, according to the all the testimony and findings, et cetera, was she instructed to teach religion in every class?
No.
Was she instructed that it permeates the entire curriculum so that when she got to mathematics or history or geography or civics or whatever this is first grade, whatever she was reading, did she have to use religious books for reading?
No, admittedly, the religious textbooks were all secular. The reading subjects were secular. There is reading in religion with the religion materials, but math is secular. Handwriting is secular. All of these things are secular, and the record proves how secular those subjects are.
Counselor, but would anybody send their child to a Catholic school if you taught them 100% religion and you weren't going to have the young man be a priest or the woman a nun? They would come out of there uneducated.
Right, exactly. My child goes to Cooley Catholic Schools, and he's in the fifth grade. That's the ironic part about this. This case has gone on so long that there's an overlap for me. And no, there's no way he would be going to a Catholic school if, in fact, the academic standards and successes of Aquinas that recently received the state award were not what they are because of the secular teachings in addition to the religious component of 30 minutes a day.
Ms. Harris, do you agree with the proposition that if your client had not been Mrs. Ostlund, but had been Sister Wendy, a nun, that the duties assigned to her would have been precisely the same as had been assigned to her in her former duties?
The duties would have been the same regarding the secular subject matter versus the religion class portion of the day. She would have met a different part of the primary duties analysis as far as she would have been more a part of a religious order. So that would have been part of the counterbalance within that analysis that would allow that to be different.
But in terms of the duties that were assigned to her by the Cooley Catholic Schools, the duties would have been the same had she been a member of a religious order, such as a nun, as opposed to a lay person.
Assuming that, yes, the secular, the teachings, the academic requirements, part of going to parochial school has always been that it's the private school and they're very good at the academic achievements and what they've done, and yes, religion would have been a component.
So the answer really is yes.
Yes.
All right.
What is the difference between a first grade teacher in this school and a first grade teacher in a public school?
The 30-minute religious component and the fact that the class goes to school or goes to a mass, which is actually a shortened version of the mass, one day a week. First graders get out of the mass what a first grade level does. And as she attested to, she's teaching basic moral principles. It's not the intellectual sphere of high school or college theology. It's the basic fundamentals, good and moral value. So that would be the difference. Otherwise, the rest of the day is the same as if you're in public school. I think that the academic standards are very high, sometimes maybe more challenging than some of them. I don't know. I don't have a child in public school to compare it, and I was a Catholic school student myself.
But does the Fair Employment Act apply in exactly the same way to both teachers?
I think that in this case, with the fact that there is no religious reason or review for the termination, and the fact that the majority of her day, primary, it was 80-90% of the day, was secular, I think the analysis is the same in this case. I don't think that Cooley Catholic School should be able to terminate someone because they're black or Mexican, or just because they're over the age of 40 and substitute somebody younger that's in. I don't think they're immune from the law, and I don't think they should be.
Does the Fair Employment Act deal with hiring, too?
It has. You can challenge if there's a wrongful discrimination in hiring, but how can you say that these are extensions of the pulpit if, in fact, you're hiring non-Catholic individuals and allowing them to teach religion? It's a contradictory argument, in my opinion.
But I mean, the religious school could hire a non-Catholic, but suppose I applied and I didn't get hired. Could I complain about it? I would make a terrific first grade.
I would think you would have the right to, and it would depend on what the job description was. How infused, are you being not hired because of your religion or your age? And they have to prove that the person that they selected was more qualified, regardless of discriminatory factors.
Hinch, I thought the law was that you can refuse to hire him based on creed under Chapter 111.
Well, it is. As far as for religion purposes, they are a private sector, so they could do that, but in this case, they've decided not to do that.
That's right, but he was at...
Yeah, and I'm sorry if I misstated that.
Yeah, I mean,
because of the first, yes.
What I'm really trying to get at is, suppose you win this case, that there is no religious impediment to the application of the Fair Employment Act. What are the implications of that for religious schools?
No different than what they have been all of the years that the precedent has been the way that it is with the primary duties test and the balancing that's always occurred in multiple facets of the law. Apart from this, I think that if we're trying to hire the best teachers, then they should be treated fairly, and I think the public policy of anti-discrimination is consistent with the Catholic faith. And to argue that it's a tenet of the faith to discriminate against somebody because of gender or race or age, that's not within the canon law, and that's not within Catholicism. I don't think it changes anything. I think it needs to be a case-by-case review. And I think that this category of teacher that just teaches religion for 30 minutes a day, 4 days a week, or 5 days a week, ought to have the fair standards apply. And there was never an issue in her 25 years regarding her teaching, her performance, or her instruction in religion.
What if it was 25% every day?
I still don't think that that's primary. I think the closer you get to 50%, then you start getting into that balance test, and then you have to kind of look at the entanglement. Does it entangle? Is there a religious reason for the termination? Then that counterbalances back, I think, into the diocesan argument if you get that far. In this case, they didn't raise the entanglement.
But if the argument is that there's a religious reason for the termination, wouldn't the government still have the opportunity to oversee whether that's correct?
I would argue that there are certain instances, and there have been, where ministers have been accused of sexual harassment, and courts have taken jurisdiction because sexual harassment is not indoctrinated by that particular religion, nor do I think it's something that should be accepted. I don't think illegal activity should be accepted under the doctrine of religion. Nobody has an absolute right to function and ignore the laws. And that's why we always have to have a balancing test, in my humble opinion. And yes, I would hire you.
Thinking it all.
You would be a good first grade teacher.
You destroyed my train of
thought. I'm sorry.
I yield to Justice Brandon.
In fact, the very situation that you're discussing now, isn't that the fact situation in the Sacred Heart case, the Sacred Heart case that came from Wisconsin, that I thought the holding in that case was that there was authority to investigate. First of all, there's protection.
Right.
The protection is you can get rid of them. You don't have to hire them. If they're not of the same faith, you can't be made to take them.
Right.
But under the Sacred Heart case, as I recall it, I think it might have even come out of Appleton area, that you can go a step further, and that is you can challenge the pretext of it. You can investigate it, at least.
Yes.
As I recall.
Right. Correct? To review whether it's going to entangle, which is getting into that next step past the ministerial component. The Court of Appeals chose not to go there, and that is going to be a decision that's in front of you now as to whether or not it's necessary, whether you stop with the ministerial exemption, and whether that was waived by the appellants in this case, because that was the challenge with the jurisdictional motion filed at the time. Everything stopped at that point. Judge Brown applied yos or yas or however we're going to say it for that case, and took a factual record consistent with the rulings and the precedent on point.
These rules would apply if Wisconsin law applied to Utah. These would apply to the Mormon Church, too.
Yes. Mormons have not been able to have polygamy because there's been the public policy balance that the sex and the illegality of those actions and the ramifications on genetics and everything else.
And a Muslim school?
Again, it's going to look at a balance. Are they trying to facilitate something that's too violent or radical that would be against the law? I think everybody is subject to an analysis to a certain extent. Otherwise, we're almost promoting a certain religion over somebody else. And we've chosen as a country not to have any religious state. So we need to have that fine line of balancing, respecting religion, but also making sure that it respects society's rights and doesn't go too far into illegal or actions against public policy.
We've gone far afield from discrimination when you
talk
about
that. Yes, we have.
This is a discrimination case. We don't have to decide whether they can regulate other behavior.
Exactly. But I think it is relevant to look at the whole view when we're talking about the impact that this case could have.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Price?
May it please the Court, I'm David Rice. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. In this case, I appear on behalf of the Labor and Industry Review Commission. Some basic red light just went on. I guess they didn't want me to.
That's it. It's a little longer to you, huh?
I'll go quickly, but not quite. This case, at its base, concerns the intersection of two very important social policies. The freedom of religion, free exercise of religion that's embodied in the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. On the other hand, you have the state and the federal government's efforts to eliminate discrimination, in this case in employment. And the question is, how do you balance those two important interests when they come into conflict, as they apparently have in this case? 35 years ago, the Rayburn Court said you essentially apply a case-by-case balancing test. And that test that they adopted was the primary duties test. Because what they really were looking at was the state shouldn't be in a position of telling churches who they should hire to be their ministers. I think we can all agree about that. On the other hand, the state legitimately may regulate, as the cases are shown, custodial positions, support staff positions, and I don't think there's much dispute about that. And it's the positions in the middle that create the cases that have gone to the appellate courts. Now, many of the justices have asked questions today about what if they teach a half an hour a day? What if they teach an hour a day? What if they pray? What about all of these issues? Well, most of these issues in the context of teachers have already been addressed by courts across the country since Rayburn. And in almost every one of those cases, and many of them are collected in the Court of Appeals decision, in this case paragraph 32, but they're also collected in the district court decision which was submitted to you by counsel or the appellant after the briefs were filed. And in all of those cases involving teachers, the teachers taught religion at least some portion of the day. In almost every one of those cases, they participated in liturgy or in prayer. And yet, in all of those cases, the court found that they were not ministerial positions and that the various laws applied, whether they were state or federal age discrimination laws, disability discrimination, Fair Labor Standards Act, a variety of regulatory measures. And so, at least as in those cases, the courts determined that there wasn't a sufficient amount or a sufficient degree, or however we're going to characterize, whatever term, whatever adjective we're going to use to describe when it's permissible and when it's not permissible to regulate, there wasn't that minimum necessary in those cases. And in each case, the government was allowed to proceed. One thing I would point out is there is protection, to some extent, against any perhaps overly liberally overzealous administrator or administrative agency. Because in this area, they don't make the choice. They gather the facts, they bring those facts to a court, this issue is immediately appealable before the case even proceeds, and at that point, the courts, and ultimately you, will tell us whether or not the particular position involved is ministerial. There's no deference to the administrative decision maker in this area.
Is there any deference? Is the determination of whether or not the duties were primary, is that a question of law or a question of fact?
It's considered to be a question of law, the application of that principle to the facts. The facts are subject to a substantial evidence standard. But once the facts are established, you, the court, decide, as a matter of law, de novo, whether or not the position is ministerial.
Yeah, that's not my question. In my mind, whether or not we decide it's ministerial, certainly, rather, that question is a question of law. My question isn't whether or not it's ministerial. My question is whether or not, once you look at these duties, the determination of what is primary. The ALJ, as administrative law judge, found, I think, in finding of fact number 25, that the primary duties were not religious. Is that a finding of fact, or is that a conclusion of law?
I'll answer it in two ways.
Okay. Let's see which one I like.
The answer that the courts have given across the country is that that is a question of law, and that the courts make that decision de novo. Given 30 years plus of administrative law experience, I would define it as a question of fact.
You would find it what?
I would define what a person's primary duties are as a factual question that's answered by the
cases
person.
Say law.
Cases say law. At least as I read them.
Isn't there a footnote in the Court of Appeals opinion that addresses this very thing? It's footnote 12. And it seems to me they kind of dodge the issue. Or get skirt the issue. But
right.
But I wanted it, your thoughts on it, so.
Right.
You have two answers, that's right. Well, it relates to deference. And Ms. Harris's brief indicates that deference should be afforded to factual findings. Do you agree with that?
Of course.
Okay. But you have no deference to questions of law. Is that your position here?
Yes. At least as to whether a person's a minister fits within that exception is a question of law. What their duties are is a question of fact.
Whether he's a minister or she's a minister, has ministerial duties, is determines what determines ministerial, primary. Is that the?
Yes, that's the standard.
Okay. So if the question of minister is law, and that's determined by what's primary, it would seem to me that primary is a question of law. And that's what the cases say, but you disagree.
Right.
Okay.
But if you...
You lose under the cases, but not necessarily here.
Right. If you look at the cases involving teachers, then I think the Eastern District Michigan case that was submitted is a good one, because it distinguishes, I think, between those cases in which teachers have been found to be ministerial versus those where they haven't been. In almost every other case, except that one and the case involving the Indian tribe in Milwaukee, which I don't really think is on point because of procedural differences, Staley. Almost all the cases that have found there to be a ministerial exception, like that Eastern District case, there's been something else. In other words, you teach religion, you do prayers, but in addition, you have to study, and in that case, you have to be certified, and you have to be on a list of people who are called, and you're treated differently than the other lay teachers or contract teachers employed by the district, and they make a distinction in that way. And there, I think there was one other case that I read last night where there was that same distinction drawn, but I don't recall the site right now. One issue that hasn't been addressed in the argument that I think deserves clarification, because when you get around to writing the decision, you'll probably look at our briefs and they address an issue that we haven't much discussed, and that is the question of what do you do if a position is ministerial, but the adjudication of the reason for the termination would not involve religion? Jaz, however it's pronounced, would answer that question. If the person's ministerial, then that's the end of the determination. And I think, after having read all these cases again, despite what I wrote in my brief, that that is the result. I mean, that that is the outcome. If the person's ministerial, then the agency can't proceed. When I first got this case, I thought, well, the diocese is arguing that she wasn't retained because she didn't have the certification that the others had. And she's arguing it's because of her age. And they could have gone to hearing and no one would have said anything about religion. No one would have discussed religious doctrine or how often she teaches religion. And so why couldn't the case have just gone forward? It made some sense to me. But then as I reflected on it, even before I reviewed all these cases, then if a person applied to be a minister and he said, I'm not being hired because I'm black or because I'm a certain age, and the congregation said, no, we didn't hire him because we found him to be disagreeable, that issue, under my theory, could be litigated because, and it's kind of like the Sacred Heart case, you could litigate it without any problem, without ever involving religion. But I think
the Sacred Heart didn't involve the ministerial
right.
exception.
But I think that really is more a question of kind of entanglement after the fact. I think that the separate free exercise clause, at least as all these cases have looked at it, and said that if the person's a minister, then that's enough. And it doesn't matter what the motivation was for the decision to terminate. I think in that respect, Mr. Birnbaum and I see eye to eye. The interesting thing would be, what if a position is found to be not ministerial, but the decision involved religious issues, so that doing the inquiry would involve the state of religion? Probably in that instance, there would also be a stop from proceeding, but that's a separate question, not before you. So to sum up, because of my lights, my time is escaping me here, even though the red light did come on awfully early the first time, we would ask that you apply the primary duties test as it's been applied by the courts throughout the 3 decades that it's been in existence, that you not announce any new wide or broad rule that would deviate from that standard, and despite what Mr. Birnbaum says, the effect of his approach, that if anybody teaches anything to do with religion or makes any prayer or participates in any liturgy, they're ministerial and they're out, the effect would be to immunize most parochial school teachers in the country and preclude them from pursuing discrimination complaints, wage complaints, and anything else that protects them in the workplace.
Counsel, your opposing counsel takes you to task a bit for not addressing some of the issues set forth in his brief. He set forth 5 issues, and you don't respond in like kind. Can you respond to your lack of response?
Sure. Let's take those issues. First issue is whether an employment position is necessarily ministerial if any of the job duties involve teaching. I've already addressed that both in my brief and in your argument. The second one, which was addressed briefly, is, well, what if the remedy can be reinstatement? Well, if the position is not ministerial, then it doesn't violate the Constitution to investigate, to hear, or to remedy if there's unlawful discrimination. So I don't think that that adds anything.
Are you saying that if this position is held not to be ministerial, and if there were discrimination found, that LIRC could order reinstatement of Ms. Oslin to teach first grade again?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that would, under your precedent, the normal remedy, even though there are exceptions in the statute if the party doesn't want to return to work and you can have front pay or something in lieu of reinstatement, the ordinary remedy is reinstatement. But this question almost presupposes that it's unconstitutional, and kind of how can the state order somebody reinstated to a position where it's unconstitutional? I think that he's right. The position is ministerial. You can't proceed, nor can you reinstate. But if he's wrong, and the position is not ministerial, then it's not anything out of the ordinary to order reinstatement if you're allowed to investigate and hear the claim. Primary duties test is unconstitutional. It's an interpretation and application state because she incorporated religious values. And, of course, I don't think the evidence supports that. The Court of Appeals found the evidence insufficient. I think my co-counsel, who knows the Catholic Cooley School is probably better than any of the rest of us in the room other than the representatives of the church who are here, addressed that question. Level of deference that you give to a religious entity's determination of ministerial or not, the courts have said, Jaws said, other cases have said, you look at that, but that's not determinative. They can't simply say this is a ministerial position, and the courts then are powerless to reach a different result. And the last issue would be the examination of the organization's hiring criteria. I think if you read my brief, I may have confused that. I think what my co-counsel addressed here is it significant whether they hire only Catholics to teach this school? And there is, as Justice Bradley pointed out, an exception in the Fair Employment Act that you can limit your hiring and employment to persons of a particular creed if that's important to that position. But that's not an issue. I thought that they were talking about, you know, my red light did go on now, but just to finish this thought, I thought they were talking about the criteria that were involved in the dismissal. And so, while I said in the footnote in my brief that somehow I thought that was kind of an adjunct to the primary duties test, I really don't think it is, but I think it's got to affect your judgment. It's like telling a jury you can't consider something if you know in the back of your mind that the case doesn't involve any dispute over religious matters, it probably somehow, at least subliminally, affects your decision about who's ministerial and who isn't. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Mr. Birnbaum, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Your Honors, I'd just like to cover a couple of issues that came up during the various presentations. And I'd like to start with Mr. Rice's, and there are a couple of issues there. Mr. Rice talked about the fact that all around the country, courts have visited this question of the ministerial exemption, and most of them have concluded that the ministerial exemption did not apply to Catholic school teachers. We disagree with that. Unfortunately, what has happened, for example, is that many of these cases didn't consider the actual details or duties of the individual positions. They were categorical cases with very little consideration of what the actual teacher did. So, for example, what they did was they took that NLRB versus Bishop case, which said that, you know, categorically it's unconstitutional for the NLRB to supervise labor relations of a church school. However, all of the cases, Grotke, Serrano, DeMarco, Dole, Southwestern Baptist, were all categorical cases. They were either FSLA cases that were seeking a statutory-wide exemption. That's not the case here. With regard to the other cases, Sacred Heart, for example, Justice Bradley mentioned, Sacred Heart really was not a ministerial definition case. That had to do with whether or not one of the asserted reasons was that person was not effective with regard to what they did, amongst other things.
What about that Geenan case? It seems to me that's on all fours. She was a fifth grade teacher. She did activities like here. She taught math and science. She taught a little bit of religion. And they said, not ministerial. How do you distinguish that case? She taught at All Saints.
Well, first of all, I agree with you. I think that looking at first blush at that case, there are issues saying, well, in the facts and circumstances of this case, there are similarities. There are also differences. For example, there was nothing in that case that talked about whether or not there was any incorporation. Because I think in the time analysis, one of the flaws of the time analysis is it goes out the window if, in fact, you concede the fact that she incorporated religious values into everything she taught. And so now I think, on the other hand, Your Honor, I think if you would take a look at the Hosanna case and also the Stately case on incorporation, I think what's more compelling about that than the Gillen case is the fact that I think Hosanna's later case, and I think actually addresses this whole issue of time, a time measurement of what is primary. I think that analysis and that approach is rife with intrusions into First Amendment issues. And I've already addressed that kind of thing. And so I would recommend to you that the better case, I think the more well-reasoned case, the one that addresses what I think could be very intrusive, is the Hosanna Tabor case, which again is remarkably similar to the facts of this case. Now, keep in mind that even those two cases aren't as compelling as this case, because in this case we have an admission by the complainant in this case that she incorporated Catholic values into everything she taught. And that wasn't just, in this record, a fanciful or general comment. And keep in mind, Your Honors, that this was not testimony rendered in the context of hotly litigated issues. These were volunteered comments on her employee evaluations outside the context of anything that was litigious. This is her view. And Justice Rogensack talked about the difference between the church's view and her view. There's actually an admission, which we cite in the first part of the brief, where the complainant in this case concedes the fact that one of her primary duties was to teach the Catholic faith. So while I think there might be some measure about whether or not it's the perception of the church or the perception of the teacher, we don't have that problem in this case, because they both agree it is undisputed. With regard to a couple of other things that Mr. Rice had mentioned, and again, Your Honors, if you want the citation to where that admission took place, I have that. But essentially, there are two things that the complainant in this case did. That is, admitted that she incorporated Catholic values into everything she taught, and also that teaching religion was one of the primary duties she did. Your Honor, it's been an honor and a privilege. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burnham. Thank you, Ms. Harris, and thank you, Mr. Rice, for your excellent arguments in this First Amendment Fair Practices case. This closes our hearing in 07-AP-496, Cooley Catholic Schools versus Lurk. Do the students want to stay for a few moments, or do they have to leave?
Yeah.